The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Kelso is a bizarro fiction writer, and he's the guest this week on the Zero Books podcast. In this episode, you'll hear why Chris is thinking about quitting writing, about how bizarro fiction was mostly just an escapist fantasy for Chris that he used to compensate for his failing love life, and why it is that, in general, writing fiction is a fool's errand. It's Thursday, July 28th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to encourage everyone to leave a review of Zero Squared on iTunes and to keep your eyes open for our upcoming membership site at the Zero Books blog. I also want to describe Chris Kelso's upcoming novel, Unger House Radicals. When aspiring and nihilistic filmmaker Vincent Bitacker falls in love with mercurial serial killer Brandon Swarthy, they decide to embark upon a bloody journey to redefine cinema and create their own subculture, ultra-realism. In this episode, you'll hear clips from Monty Python, some homegrown vaporwave, a bit of Fry and Laurie, and a short clip from Portlandia. The music you're listening to right now is Macintosh Plus again, because I can't get enough vaporwave. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Chris Kelso and I discuss giving up and the bizarre. Chris Kelso is a Scottish writer, illustrator, editor, and journalist. He has been published frequently in literary and university publications across the UK, the US, and Canada. And he and Garrett Cook are the co-creators of the bizarro literary journal, The Imperial Youth Review. And his own novels and books include A Message from the Slave State, Moose Jaw Frontier, Transmatic, and The Black Dog Eats the City. So, Chris Kelso, welcome to the Zero Books podcast, Zero Squared.
Thanks for having me, Douglas.
Yeah. You know, I almost forgot, but it's a fact that you're my publisher. You're my editor over at the Imperial Youth Review.
That's very true. I think I actually came to you to get something specifically because I'd been following your work for quite a long time. And I think I read Billy Moon as well, which was, in my opinion, quite a departure for you. I felt like that was your kind of foray into something a bit more mainstream, and you were definitely the kind of marquee signing for that particular issue. So thank you for...
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I know a number of people who are in that publication. Like, I've hung around with Ed Morris. He and I used to work together at the Oregon Symphony. And Cameron Pierce, of course, is a big-time editor here and who used to live in Portland, recently moved. And Cameron Pierce actually was the first one to tell me that I was a bizarro writer, or he wanted me to be. And you are not only a bizarro writer, but you are an editor of a very beautiful-looking and interesting journal, the Imperial Youth Review. I imagine it's one of the more important journals in that genre. But I'm always a little confused, or I'm not exactly sure if I've ever quite gotten it down as to what bizarro is. So tell me, how do you think of bizarro fiction? And when you edit the Imperial Youth Review, what are you looking for?
My own interpretation of bizarro is much different to the premise, the original premise, which was I had like a heavy focus on a kind of B-movie culture, extremely gory horror, very dialogue heavy, easily accessible for people who aren't necessarily into quite turgid prose, for example. Like, it's really very spare, usually quite outlandish themes. But I first got into Bizarro, I think, because I was attracted to the no holds barred approach that it had to literature. And I think at the time of my life, I probably just dropped out of university for the first time when I was doing law, which was a horrible, just an awful time in my life, really. I was becoming quite disillusioned with academia, and I wanted a real escape from all that kind of stuff. It was probably Carlton Mellick the Third. In fact, it definitely was Carlton Mellick. He's the kind of gateway drug into Bizarro for most people, probably because Satan Burger, it was like one of the last books to be put on trial, I think, as well, because there was a whole issue where somebody had read it and committed some kind of crime. And but I think because of that, that actually garnered quite a lot of attention for Bizarro. So, and I think The Guardian actually did a really nice article on it, which gave it even more exposure. There was a lot of information on it. So Carlton Mellick was the first one that really got me in. And then eventually I came to people like Cameron Pierce and even Garrett Cook. I was a big admirer of Garrett before I ever got into any of the magazine endeavour, for example. To me, Bizarro, it's not about I think there are some people that are kind of Bizarro purists out there who still want to have the original, which is that it should be outlandish, it should be quite scatological humour and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's just... it's like the first time you ever read Burroughs, or the first time you ever discover there are people like Burroughs out there. There are no rules. It really does celebrate the writer. There's no censorship at all in Bizarro, and that was really appealing to me. But at the time, when I was a teenager, like 18 or 19, discovering that was a massive deal, and I knew there and then that was what I wanted to get into. It's got more in common with surrealism for me, rather than the B-movie schlock.
I have in front of me right now Kevin Dole's manifesto, which he claims is not a manifesto, that's entitled "So What the Fuck Is This All About?" And it was published in 2005 on a Bizarro forum, and I guess it was a rather influential manifesto. Kevin Dole is going to be staying in my house next weekend when he comes through town for the Lovecraft Festival. Let me just read a little something here from What the Fuck Is This All About and get your reaction. Let's see. Allow me to explain by way of example. Harlan Ellison was never a fan of the phrase science fiction, at least not when applied to his own work. A more appropriate term, he felt, would be surreal fantasy. After all, even though the bad guy in I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream was a supercomputer, it might as well have been the devil. Nor did H.P. Lovecraft like it when people called his stories supernatural. He preferred weird fiction, because what did his hateful cosmic nightmares have to do with the Victorian ghosts and goblins? And William S. Burroughs was not, despite what prosecutors said, no matter how explicit Naked Lunch got, a pornographer. It seems to me that in this piece, he's kind of defining Bizarro as something different from other genres, more by sort of negatively. It's like, it's not this, it's not that. But in my mind, Bizarro did early on get associated with, I mean, when I encountered it, with haunted vaginas and, you know, rupturing pimples and leather gear and just extreme imagery of all kinds.
There are people like Tom Bradley, I don't know if you're familiar with him, very intellectual, very philosophical and esoteric, and less about the extreme imagery, although there is extreme imagery in there. But it is still very much Bizarro. And I think what Kevin was saying as well was that it is almost beyond definition. Like, Bizarro, there are no limits, so it can be anything in a way. It can absorb whatever it wants. And I think as well with your own work, Douglas, I think you're also one of the more intellectual Bizarro writers, if you would even consider yourself a Bizarro writer. I'm not sure if you do.
Yeah, I'm not uncomfortable being called Bizarro at all.
I genuinely don't think I am a bizarro writer, if I'm being honest. The main overarching plot in every story I've got is the slave state, which is very science fiction. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that there's a place beyond the fourth dimension, and it's a kind of slave planet where humans are made to work in labour enclaves for the rest of their lives under this alien technocracy. And, you know, so it's, I think that's probably just science fiction rather than bizarro. I don't really know. I think with anything, I mean, bizarro in general is probably quite a new, it is definitely a new genre. So they're probably quite keen to latch on to, I think they want to spread a big net and catch as many people as they can to call their own in a way. And I think, but I would probably say that my stuff was probably more science fiction. I'm actually from a really small town in Scotland called Cumnock. Mm-hmm. And it is just probably the worst place in the world. It's kind of like Sarajevo, but without the charm. It's very insular, very small town society. Everybody knows each other. It's an old mining town. Obviously, the mines, Margaret Thatcher, the mines were shut down in Scotland. So there's no industry. So the people are generally quite bold, uninspiring, small-minded. That sounds like I'm having a go at people for coming. Like, no, it's not even their fault. They're just frustrated and bored because there's nothing to do. Really, there's nothing. There's no outlet for them. They're no stimulated creatively or anything like that. So I was coming for a place like that. I was a very geeky child and a remarkably unpopular child as well. But my mum was going through university herself. She was going through medical school. So we eventually left Cumnock to go to a place called Kilmarnock, which is the nearest town out from Cumnock. And it's actually nearer Glasgow, which is probably the main city you'll probably have heard of mm-hmm. in Scotland. But Kilmarnock's not that much better. It's just, it is better than Cumnock. There is industry and there's a town centre and there are some things, there's a library, there are some things to do. I was 9 when we left Cumnock.
Okay.
And we stayed in this kind of train spotting style crack den. It was awful. It was just a terrible place. And my dad was working, he was the only person really making any money. So he worked in a factory that made jeans, denim jeans. So it wasn't a lot of money. But eventually mum got a job, we moved. It was much better. But going to a new school, that was more isolation. And I was already like a mess, like just a really quiet and withdrawn wee guy. And then so going to school, going to secondary school, going to high school was also a bit of a nightmare. And then girls come along and you kind of get the girls you want and there's so much distraction. And so there's all that really boring adolescent stuff, angsty stuff that I never really shook off, to be honest. So I was reading a lot of science fiction, like I was reading a lot of Samuel Delaney, reading a lot of Philip K. Dick. I came to reading really through comic books, and there's a great comic, I don't know if you know The Beano, it's like a British comic, it's really light-hearted. Dennis the Menace was in it. Mm-hmm. It's like a really light-hearted comic, but that was when I was very young, I'd be reading a lot of stuff like that. And then gradually coming to novels. And I was always, even for the beginning, I was never somebody who read like mainstream or young adult books. I was always attracted to quite confrontational literature. Like, I think the first book I ever read was Martin Amis, Dead Babies, which is really, it's quite a fucked up book. And I read that when I was about 12. That was when I started to read novels. And I knew that was the type of book that I wanted to read. It was only kind of stuff that I found engaging on that level. But that probably fueled the kind of angsty side of me because I was reading stuff that was completely reinforcing my negative attitude towards things. So I'd go to school, and school was a nightmare socially. But I did all right at school. I did enough to get into to go to law school. And I remember my first year at university, people were coming to talk to me. Like people actually wanted to talk to me. And I just rejected them. Like I just was not ready or interested in talking to them. Like I would meet them on like the first week, and I would hang about with them. We'd go to the dorms, we'd go for coffee, and everything would be great. And I should have been the kernels of a real friendship. But then the next day, I would have absolutely no interest in seeing them. I wouldn't even go to lectures. I would just go to the toilet and read books. Or I would go to the cinema and watch a weird film, like, alone. So you can imagine what a fucking nightmare I probably was, to be honest. So Bizarro was just made for somebody like that.
Now, was this as an undergraduate or as in law school?
This is an undergraduate. This is at Strathclyde University.
Because I remember when I was an undergraduate that I felt extremely kind of lost, like I had not understood what leaving home would be, even though I was not particularly happy at home anymore. You know, as you get older, you want to leave, but it was a tough time. Were you homesick at all, or was there something else going on?
It's strange. I actually didn't leave home. I just commuted in from home every day. And by the end, I was missing exams and I wasn't showing up, and I was just lying to mum and dad, telling them I was going to university, but I was actually just getting on the Glasgow bus to go and walk about Glasgow and just have experiences, going to the cinema, and I'm doing it totally alone. I'm not interested in anybody at this point. Although I did actually get a girlfriend. She dumped me, basically. I had this great girlfriend who was far too good for me. She was really popular, and I've got, to this day, and this isn't looking for a sympathy, but I've got no idea why she ever actually went out with me, to be honest, because I was just a nightmare. I wasn't fun to be around. I was just terrible company. I was miserable. I was cynical. But I think eventually she had enough, and she dumped me. And that was just before I was ready to go to university.
You were heartsick when you started going to university.
Definitely.
And so you were moping about and skipping classes and wandering the streets.
I was the tortured romantic hero or anti-hero.
What's your first Bizarro book you find heartsick there in Glasgow, not going to classes and lying to your parents? What are you reading? What's that book?
It was probably Ape Shit, I think. It was Carlton Mellick, kind of Cabin in the Woods style horror thing he did. It was a kind of metaphysical horror he did.
So were you writing at this point when you were skipping school?
I was writing, but I think it was unmitigated dog shit, the stuff I was writing at the time. Because obviously it's quite raw, and every character is just me, really, and kind of pretentious, hacky writing that I used to do. I was always writing really convoluted, verbose prose, really. So it was just shit. It was just terrible stuff. It's like the stuff, I mean, I don't know, have you came across any of the stuff you used to write when you were that age?
Yes, recently I had my friend, I published some essays that I wrote in a friend's zine, and because of Facebook, he and I are communicating again. There was probably a 15-year gap between us even talking at all, and he lived in New York, and he dug up some old copies of the zine that he had published back in the early 90s, and he sent me, like, a PDF of them. And I started reading the essay that I had written for him, and I just thought, oh, my God, this guy, I wouldn't want to hang around him. You know, I wouldn't want to talk to him in a bar or anything. Wouldn't have a beer with this guy. He's so pretentious and so pretentious, and at the same time, sort of dumb. And so I didn't want anything to do with my former writing. But that was when I decided. I mean, I was had already decided when I was writing that direct that that I was going to be a writer. I mean, and I never stopped after that. It was actually a little before then that I had decided. I decided my senior year of high school that I wanted to be a writer because I realized I was not going to be a movie actor. So, what's the next most romantic?
Was that the original goal? Was it movie?
I wanted to be an actor. Yeah, when I was a kid, because I'd been in a couple school plays, and the only times I ever got praise from adults was for those plays I was in. So I thought, I'll be an actor. And also, I loved, I love movies and TV and novels too, and love playing pretend and pretending to be the characters. Like, I go to a movie and then want to pretend to be the whatever character, heroic character I'd just seen in the movie afterwards. Well past the point where most kids stop, I was still doing that kind of thing at 13 or 14. So,
what is your relationship with some of your older work? Like, even your earlier published work, do you look back on that and hate it, or are you still pretty happy with it? Or?
You know, when it's published and it's been praised, I feel like I have a bit of a armor against my own judgments of it, but I'm not at all objective about this stuff. Like my most recent novel, I hated it until some people started reviewing it and saying nice things about it, and now I like it. And the short story collection, my first one, yeah, I think it has some good stories in it. I think sometimes the writing is a little too spare. I'd like to develop, I've been developing and still would like to be less relying on the same few techniques and expand my range a bit more. But by the time I got published, I was almost 30. I was like 28, 29 when I was starting to get published. Yeah. So I don't feel too badly about that stuff, but.
Because I think I've got that part of the problem with some of my earlier published stuff was actually published just as I'd left university. So that guy that I used to be, that pain in the arse, has got stuff out there and it's like a different person wrote it. And I really, really hate it. And I think it's dictated in a way my feelings about my books in general. Whenever they come out, I'm so used to, like, before it's published, I'll think it's great and I'll be like, oh, this is going to be this is the best thing I've ever done. Finally, it seems mature, and then it'll come out in the book and it'll be like a completely different entity. Like, I'll just suddenly see nothing but flaws in it. And that's still happening today. Like, and if I'm being honest, like I've not actually really told anybody this, except a few close writer pals of me, but I'm actually thinking about stepping away for the whole writing thing in general. Because I never really go over that. I mean, you were saying, like, you can take, like, if you start to see good reviews for your books, it makes you feel like, right, so there are people that maybe I'm being too subjective about the book and being harshly critical of it. But I still feel like I'm probably far too, my own self-importance, sense of self-importance, but I still think, like, my opinion is the most important, and I'm really struggling to justify to myself why I'm writing in a way. I'm really struggling. I've got a few books still to come out, but I think I'm going to save myself that whole situation where I'm, because I plunge into in a sense I've always been that angsty teenager and I always will be. Like, I'm probably maybe too critical to have gone into something like writing, because it's the criticism you're going to get. I mean, can you remember your first bad review, for example?
Yes, well, I can remember the one that after last week's apocalypse, I got good reviews everywhere except in the Willamette Week, which is an alternative weekly in Portland. Willamette Week just trashed me. And some of the things that I would criticize myself for, he did. Some of the things I wouldn't, that I think are actually my strengths, I was criticized for. But the main problem with it was that not only was it really the worst review I'd received ever for any of my work, but also it was the only review that my friends and colleagues saw. You know, none of my friends and colleagues are reading Locus or the Publisher's Weekly. You know, they're reading the Willamette Week. So for people in my everyday life, this was the judgment of my work, and that was tough. And it was hard. Yeah, I went into a depression for a couple of days. And so I completely relate. When you're pursuing a career as a writer, so much of your own sense of self-worth and identity gets wrapped up in that in a way that maybe it's unlike anything else. I mean, it may be like being a painter or a musician or an actor even, maybe. You know, if you're like pursuing accounting, people don't get that wrapped up in it. And I guess if you feel like you can get a little distance from the work and think of it as a project that you're doing rather than a person you're becoming, it gets easier.
You could be right.
But do you think of it that way? Let's go back to when you started. Was this a way for you to kind of become a person in your own mind? Because it was for me, I know, to pursue writing.
To get into writing, yeah. To try and become a writer.
Yeah.
It probably was, because you don't really have any sense of yourself when you're a teenager. You don't know anything, really. I think you just think you do. I think because there was too many negative things happening around me, writing was like a therapeutic thing. So I had no intention of actually getting published or letting anybody ever read it. I was just doing it. It was just for something today that were on my terms, really. But eventually, I think Bizarro, do you know, the one thing about Bizarro is that it made me want to get published. It made me feel like I could get published. Mm-hmm. I had that kind of romantic image of somebody who gets published. They're suddenly respected and accepted, and it was all the things I didn't have at the time. So I think probably most people, that's quite an appealing thing. I always really wanted to be an artist. That was always what I thought I was going to get into. I thought I would end up as a painter or doing comic books or just any kind of art.
How are you liking it down the mine, Ken?
Oh, it's not too bad, Mum. We're using some new tungsten carbide drills for the preliminary coalface scouring operations.
Oh, that sounds nice, dear. Tungsten carbide drills? What the bloody hell's tungsten carbide drills?
It's something they use in coal mining, Father.
It's something they use in coal mining, Father. You bloody fancy talk since you left London.
Well, not that again.
Oh, he's had a hard day, dear. His new play opens at National Theatre tomorrow.
Oh, that's good.
Good? Good? What do you know about it? What do you know about getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to fly to Paris, back at the Old Vic for drinks at 12, sweating the day through press interviews, television interviews, then getting back here at 10 to wrestle the problem of an homosexual nymphomaniac drug addict involved in the ritual murder of a well-known Scottish footballer? That's a full working day, lad. And don't you forget it!
Oh, don't shout at the boy, Father.
Hampstead wasn't good enough for you, was it? You had to go punching off to Barnsley. You and your coal mining friends.
So let's talk a little bit about your work. It sounds to me like you're not very happy with your work. Mm. Let me ask you, what do you think the strongest part of what you've done, say in something like Transmatic or Slave State, would be?
But it's funny because the last book, the Dissolving Zinc Theatre, that's the one I've spent the most time on, and I still think it's the best thing I've done. I don't hate it just as much as the rest. I've got to a point now where I've probably got a voice, like I've got a style that's mine, but it's just, I don't know, I don't know if it's the acclaim. I think I just need more reassurance with the whole thing, and it's one of the good things about Bizarro is it's got a great community. It's got a lot of reviewers and bloggers and people who read anything Bizarro.
Right.
So you're always going to get reviews and people interested in your stuff. But like, for example, was it Tor that put out Billy Moon?
Yes.
It was Tor. Right? They're a massive publisher. So you've made the transition from small time indie writer into still an alternative indie writer, but Tor are a massive publisher. Mm-hmm. So I suppose there's that kind of validation that will come with that. Like,
yeah, definitely. But what happened with me is that I got published at Tor, and then my next book is back with Nightshade, because the book Billy Moon, while it did fairly well critically, didn't sell. And, it sold some. It sold enough to make a profit for them, but it didn't sell at the level that it would be a sure thing for them to offer me a second book, just offer it to me, you know. The idea was they would always be willing to look at what I sent them, but they didn't have a contract ready for me on my second book. And also the editor I'd been working with was fired. So I went to Nightshade, which was who had published my short story collection. Having worked with Tor, which they published a lot of great stuff, they published a lot of crappy stuff, I realized that I'm happy writing books. I'm not necessarily going to knock myself for not being with Tor again, or, you know, I would like to make more money from my writing than I do. That's all. I don't need any more validation from it.
Did you ever need more validation?
Oh, yeah. When I was 27? Absolutely. You know? Yeah. You know, I needed to... I didn't even... See, you've written how many books now? Like 5, 6?
I think it's probably 8, actually.
Eight novels. Yeah. I've got 2 novels. I'm 44. You're 27. I hadn't written any of my any novels by the time I was 27. I had written short stories, and none of them had been published yet. The first published acceptance I got was I was 28. It was for it was in Amazing Stories magazine.
That's an amazing first sale, though. Amazing Stories, that's brilliant.
Right. Well, I've been published in one or two. I think one other. No, 2. I've been published when I was 18 in something called The Fiction Primer, and I got paid $25, and it was a chapbook out of someone's basement in, like, South Carolina, and it was for new writers. And then I got published again when I was around 25 in something called Next Phase, which was a zine. And then I went to Clarion. Then it was several years before I got... my first professional sale with Amazing Stories. And then, you know, a year went by and I got another couple sales, and another year went by and I got another couple sales. And I putted around like that for a while, and then decided to try to write novels. But with the thing is, also going to Clarion was nice because I got to talk to professional writers who had pretty mainstream success and get advice and get validation from them. And I spent 6 weeks only on my writing. But you've been validated from probably your first book, right? You've gotten published all along.
I know what you mean. I think I'm just probably quite an impatient person as well.
Yeah.
I think just because as well, like, I think people might look at it and see eight published books or like a bunch of books that I've edited and think, oh, like he must be quite prolific. But I think there's varying degrees of quality throughout my back catalogue. So... I would really like, I think, you know, I mean, I might end up just, I'm saying just now that, or that I might end up, my plan is to walk away from writing, but I could be completely wrong. Like, I'm 27 and I've got that kind of like arrogant know-it-all thing going on. I don't know. Like, I could end up coming back to 8 years down the line, spend a lot of time on a book and actually write something that I'm happy with and show it to some, maybe like industry professionals or professional writers. I've got loads of pals. That's one good thing about that early baptism of fire, was that you get to meet all these great writers and you get to meet people that you read, like Carlton Mellick and like yourself. And so maybe the book that I'm happy with, like the great book, it is in there somewhere, and I just need to take a wee step back for it and throw myself into something else. I do still find writing very therapeutic, and when I get an idea, I'm still completely compelled to go and write it down and develop it and expand upon it. And sometimes it turns into nothing, sometimes it turns into a book. And I think, I mean, I still live in Ayrshire and I still live in Kilmarnock, which I was telling you before, it's quite a small town, there's not a lot of things happening. in Kilmarnock. So it is a good way of keeping the brain active. And I do love writing. I mean, I think it's a strange time to have gotten me for an interview, to be honest. Because this decision that I'm talking to you about is something that's been, I've been mulling it over for a couple of months, and I've not really spoken about it to anybody. So you're probably getting this kind of like armchair psychiatrist unintentionally.
Be useful if we started by your telling me something about your state of mind at the moment. How would you describe it? Would you say you were happy or depressed, confident or unsure of yourself? What words would you use to describe your mood, would you say? Take your time.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Your problem seems to center around the delusion that you are a psychiatrist. And that everyone you speak to is a patient of some sort. This is a rare but not unheard of syndrome.
I've read some of your work. It seems to me your characters are really untethered, and that your books, they're seemingly purposely ungrounded. And I do that too. I found myself seeing my own approach in a way in your work, because one of the things I'm trying to do, especially in a book like, both After the Saucers Landed and Billy Moon, is communicate to the readers that the world that we think is solid is less solid than we think, and that we have a relationship to the world of, as creators of the world, that we're not, we don't like to be aware of. So the world becomes untethered a lot. You know, my big influences, one of them is Philip K. Dick, and he gave a speech about how to take the universe, how to make the universe fall apart, how to build a universe that falls apart 2 days later, something like that. And it feels like you're writing about characters and universes where that happens, but that they're all very unhappy. A lot of the characters are unhappy, and that drives them is sort of a hedonism. Do you feel that's true?
Definitely. I think that's definitely true. And I think another thing about like the books I'm putting out are that they themselves, I think, come across as quite self-conscious. Knowing the sense that it's naively written or in, like, although I think I have got a bit of kind of that, there is an element of that to it as well with the stuff I was writing when I was younger. But it's like they know their books. And you were right when you were saying about the world being untethered and the shifting dimensions of reality, and everybody's disorientated and miserable. And it's just that it's a complete reflection of growing up in small town Ayrshire, probably, because that's what it feels like. But Philip K. Dick was, I mean, he was like a massive influence on me as well. And his exegesis is brilliant. And I just, I love the whole thing. That I think it would be great as well if this wasn't like the idea of the Matrix. I think is probably a terrifying thing for most people, but the slave state to me is there are people who are going to enjoy the ignorance of like the surface reality, and there are people who are going to want to find the answer. And I think the people that think they want to know the answer, they always end up regretting it. So I think I would love to be blissfully ignorant. And I think all the characters in my books are always like, they always regret that curiosity that led them to reality, to the true reality. Because it's always, you know, if you're halfway intelligent or self-aware, you probably are going to have a bit of an existential crisis.
We have a deal, Mr. Reagan.
You know, I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss.
Then we have a deal.
I don't want to remember nothing. Nothing. You understand? And I want to be rich. You know, someone important. Like an actor.
Whatever you want, Mr. Regan.
I think I was definitely, if I'm being honest, one of the main reasons why I wanted to write was definitely for the blowjobs. Because I was probably quite sex-starved. I think most people have, they embark on at least some kind of sexual conquest when they're in their teens. And I was pretty late coming into it. So I think I thought like writing would definitely make me interesting. But at the same time, my intentions, I think, were purer than that. I think it wasn't just the blowjobs or the women or even when it comes to women, no at all. No, it's a fucking nightmare.
You know, I'm married and we have a good marriage and all, but I've never, ever had any success with women based on my writing. You know, and the few times that maybe there was a hint of that, it was the last thing in the world I actually really wanted. How could it work to be a writer to get laid? You go into a basement, you know, never get any sun and pound your keyboard, and that's sexy somehow? I don't think it is.
But then you think about people like John Updike or Norman Mailer or even Charles Bukowski, like they were surrounded by women. Although I suppose that was a different era, and you probably had a different status back then if you were a writer with only modicum of success. But I think now there's such the marketplace is so saturated now. I think people are less impressed by it as well. You know, anybody can write, especially with blogging coming up. Like everybody's a writer now, and I've always been looking for women. Like I'm quite, you know, I'm keen. I'm a womanizer at heart. I think I've just never been able to fulfill my potential. But I've never, if anything, it's been a hindrance, to be honest. I think maybe like on two occasions, I've dropped I write books. If somebody asks me what I do, and it usually ends up bombing, like it ends up sort of, they lose interest. Maybe it's just the type of girls I'm going after as well. Like the pretty girls are, Scotland's a weird place, Douglas.
Yeah.
It's a small place, and there's no to say that there's no, there's a great science fiction movement in Glasgow, believe it or no, with Hal Duncan and Neil Williamson and Douglas Thompson and all the people who are, and Carol Johnson, who are really emerging with their own, you know, there's been a real influx of great writers, especially recently, and there is an audience for it, but I don't know if it's as captive as in other places, like in America, like I don't know, where are you in Portland? Just
yeah, I'm in Portland.
Yeah, every second person in Portland probably writes books because it's such a, in my mind's eye, that's like Portland and Oregon and all that are like really cultured places.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably didn't stand out enough over there.
No, I'm sure I have a warped view of how people are because I've lived in Portland for 20 years.
About the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Okay. She's nice.
We're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I am so weird with that gas pedal. That thing just moves the whole vehicle forward.
All right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great.
Okay, so let's sum up what you've said so far in this interview. That you were kind of a sad, brokenhearted man when you found Bizarro. That you've written it for a long while, but you're not very happy with any of it. You're thinking about quitting, and your relationships are falling apart because of it. Would you like to read some of the work that's been ruining your life?
I could do that if you want. I've got a book down the stairs. I'll have to go and get it, though.
I'd love to do that.
So I'm going to read a wee bit from Terence Mephisto and Viscera Eyes, which was a short story collection that I had, and this is the title story, and it's about a dog who wants to become a writer, but it turns out he's actually a man who's been led to believe he's a dog. Terence is this dog, and he wants to be a writer, so he writes this. He learns how to write, but he is a human. He learns how to write. He writes this terrible novel. He submits it to a kind of vanity publishing style thing called Mephisto, which is actually an amorphous blob that consumes organisms into it. Terence sat in the park, a shadow etched towards him. "Hello, Mr. Mephisto," he barked instinctively. A voice emerged in response like a choir of demons. "Mephisto is not one thing, I'm just the civic intelligence, the face of Mephisto. Its breath was of soil, damp and eternal, one with the alkaline earth, but the corpus was different. There was nothing organic about it. It seemed to have been cobbled together with old Pepsi cans and television sets stuck in a nebulous non-channel, filled between with some acrid heavy-duty adhesive. It motioned forward in a slithering cube of gelatinous matter. Temporary eyes blinked open, then disappeared beneath the body of the bubbling, shapeless amoeba thing. Mistake of the elder gods. Well, hello all the same. It bled fluid from every pore. Viscera eked from the ducts. Viscera eyes looked out at him with a cannibal's hunger. At least it seemed to understand Terence's inarticulate barking. "You're Mephisto?" Terence asked. "Mephisto is a network of individuals. Did you know that the mind doesn't end within the prison of the skull?" No, I didn't. Terence resisted the urge to clean his genitals. "We act in concert to accomplish goals beyond individual agents to fulfil the hive wants, the propagation of information, in other words, the ultimate collaboration." Terence wasn't convinced. He felt uneasy being out in the park without a leash on. Mephisto was aware of the dynamic evolution of knowledge between entities, and eventually, through networking, we achieved distributed cognition. I'm just a dog. Mutualistic symbiosis, a knowledge ecosystem. We hope to increase the emergence of systematic acuity through stigmergy. Terence squinted in confusion. You'll be connected by hyperlinks, and your neurons and synapses will be replaced and amalgamated with the superorganism. I'm not sure that this is what I was expecting. Things rarely are. You will get published. You will be part of something that commands respect. The leash is off. The leash is off. We just need to attach the vector. Don't worry, it has no taste receptors, so it won't enjoy the feeding process too much, we promise. Well, that's good to know. Mephisto materialised a tick-like creature engorged with blood. This will help transmit the virus into your system that leads to amalgamation. He placed the wriggling anthropod in the back of Terence's head. He felt it burrow deep into the fur behind his neck. But what do you look like? I mean, the real you. The one up in the control centre. I, Lem, look more like a mole rat. I'm rodent-like anyway, wrinkled skin. My eyelids are mere slits which suggest I have pure visual acuity. This knowledge warmed Terence. It was good to know there was a simple animal up there just like him. He could really be part of something and succeed. He felt the vector bore through his flesh. This is the last time Terence would think for himself.
See, that's great stuff. There's a bit of Kafka to it there. Like, you wake up one morning and you're a cockroach, only this time it's a cockroach that wakes up one morning and the computer finds out that he's a human being.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that as well, because I was in Prague earlier on in the year with an ex-girlfriend who then dumped me, which also relates to the theme of this entire interview.